KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Scott Simon. This hour, a Florida manufacturer who believes President Trump's tariffs could be good for business, but it may take years. Ray Mendoza on his powerful new film, Warfare, taken from the story of his own Navy SEALs platoon in Iraq. And John Kenney's new novel about an obituary writer who hits send and makes a mistake.
Bud Stanley, the first man to perform open heart surgery on himself, died today in a hot air balloon accident. He was 44. His wife, Miss France, has confirmed the death.
His Ryan Wise novel, I See You've Called In Dead. First, we have our newscast. Today is Saturday, April 5th, 2025.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Noor Rahm. Stock indexes dropped sharply this week after President Trump announced he's imposing a new round of tariffs on products from nearly all countries. China announced it's imposing a 34% tax on U.S. goods starting next week. NPR's Ron Elving reports Trump believes it will be worth it in the long run.
They say the retaliation we're seeing from China and elsewhere will be transitory. They say our trading partners will knuckle under and lower their own tariffs. And most important, they say American companies will bring home the jobs that they've shifted overseas and that other countries will shift their manufacturing to the U.S., creating jobs here rather than in their own countries.
NPR's Ron Elving. Many American shopkeepers are getting ready to order their supplies for the critical holiday shopping season. Now, many are trying to calculate how much these shipments will actually cost, given sweeping new tariffs on virtually all imports. NPR's Alina Selyuk reports.
Tariffs get paid by American importers, and often it's small business owners like Alfred Mai in San Francisco. He sells card games for families and parties at his company ASM Games, and right now he's trying to figure out how much to stock up for the all-important holiday season.
I'm faced with the decision of having to spend all this cash, a lot of cash,
or save a lot of it to pay for tariffs when his cards arrive from China. Mai says during the pandemic and the supply chain crisis that followed, he was able to keep prices steady, cutting into his own profit margin. But now,
we don't really have any more margins to give. And so for the very first time, we might have to raise prices. And I hate the idea of that.
But that's the reality for many companies like his. Alina Seluk, NPR News.
Early this morning, the Senate approved a budget blueprint that calls for reductions in federal spending and multi-trillion dollars in tax cuts. The vote was 51-48 in the Republican-controlled body. It fell mostly along party lines, but two Republicans voted with the Democrats in opposing the measure. With cleanup underway in parts of Tennessee hit by deadly tornadoes, more severe weather is in the forecast for the region. Mariana Bacalho of member station WPLN reports.
Some areas of Tennessee are expected to get up to 8 inches of rain through the weekend, which could lead to flash flooding. Patrick Sheehan, director of the Tennessee Emergency Management Agency, says the flooding could be worse than what hard-hit areas have already experienced this week.
We do expect that much of Tennessee will experience or be near severe weather, and flooding is almost guaranteed to happen or be worsen from what we're experiencing right now.
Damaging winds will be the main concern when storms are strongest Saturday afternoon. The National Guard is stationed across the state and ready for potential rescue missions. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Baca-Yao in Nashville.
This is NPR News. The United Nations issued a call today for nations around the world to help Myanmar after the devastating earthquake last month. Officials now say more than 3,300 people died. A British-based activist whose case has been cited by Vice President Vance as an important freedom of expression case has been convicted of breaching an abortion clinic protection zone. Vicky Barker reports from London.
Livia Tosici-Bolt says all she did was stand outside an abortion clinic in the city of Bournemouth, holding a sign reading, "Here to talk if you want." Her prosecution, she said, was a violation of her right to free speech, specifically speaking out against abortion. Vice President J.D. Vance had highlighted her case as an example of how freedom of expression is under threat in the U.K. But the judge who convicted her noted this case had not been about the rights or wrongs of abortion. Rather, Tosichi Bolt had violated an order banning all protests outside the clinic. She was freed on the condition that she not reoffend in the next 2 years. She says she will continue her, quote, fight for free speech. For NPR News, I'm Vicki Barker in London.
Hundreds of demonstrations are planned across the U.S. today to protest the actions of President Trump and his advisor, billionaire Elon Musk. Organizers say they've planned events in all 50 states and the District of Columbia to show their anger at Trump's efforts to reshape the federal government in the 2.5 months he's been in office. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Thank you for being with us. President Trump's announcement this week of sweeping tariffs rocked the global economy. Stock markets tumbled. China has already retaliated with tariffs of its own on U.S. products. Economists warn there will be higher prices and slower economic growth. President Trump said one of the main reasons for the tariffs is to help remake the domestic economy.
Jobs and factories will come roaring back into our country, and you see it happening already. We will supercharge our domestic industrial base.
But how realistic is that objective? Doug Adams is president of Adams Corp, a manufacturing company that specializes in medical technology. He joins us now from Tampa. Thanks very much for being with us, Mr. Adams.
Yes, sir. Thanks for having me.
What's your reaction to these tariffs, effectively taxes paid by the American people and businesses on goods from abroad?
My first initial reaction was they were a little bit stronger than everyone really thought they would potentially be. What we've seen thus far from some of our customers is just really the unknown in regards to the actual numbers that will be applied to their goods and services that they potentially could be bringing into the United States, and a lot of pause, you know, which traditionally leads to things that they might be doing already that they want to, you know, slow down.
How could your business be affected?
In the short term, I don't necessarily think there'll be any sort of effect. In the long term, you know, investment certainly could change. We help customers automate their medical device factories. They potentially could look at, you know, the scenario where they might hamper investment or put projects on hold that would they otherwise went forward with.
What about President Trump's goal of trying to bring back manufacturing jobs and operations back to the U.S.?
I think it's a strong goal. In a perfect scenario, that would be great. We could bring back manufacturing to levels that it once was, but it's going to take time. The single biggest challenge we have in the manufacturing side is that we just don't have enough people that are in the manufacturing world. You know, a lot of those jobs left in the 70s, 80s, early 90s. I mean, we weren't training for them. You know, we weren't sending our kids to school to be able to talk about or do those things and be prepared for those jobs. And then the other side of it would be from an automation standpoint, we need those skill sets as well. And then lastly, just your capacity. So even if we did bring back manufacturing here to the United States, it's going to take a while to ramp up our existing manufacturing facilities. A lot of them are already at capacity. So giving them the ability to turn on a dime is just really not something you can do. And I know a lot of big companies have already had discussions around bringing manufacturing back, but some of those projects could take anywhere from 2 to 5 years.
Let me ask you about medical technology. How important is it to try and bring medical technology back, manufacturing back from overseas?
I think it's critical from a geopolitical standpoint, having the ability to build it on your own, regardless of, you know, if it's made in a friendly or an unfriendly country, not being able to control our own destiny in regards to the items that our citizens would need, I look at it as a very big risk. And the challenge is that, you know, some of the lower end medical devices, like something simple as a Band-Aid or a mask, they're very difficult to manufacture those low cost here in the United States without a significant investment in automation. And a lot of that automation has been invested abroad. We don't have the ability to make our own medical devices that could be needed in time of a pandemic or, you know, even in a time of geopolitical conflict. Yeah, I think that's a big risk to our country.
But it takes time to develop those kind of resources, doesn't it?
Yeah, to build up, say, for example, a ground-up factory, you're probably, you know, 2 to 4 years, depending on the entity that you're in, the local permitting and state permitting and, you know, federal permitting and getting FDA approval and that med device to be made in that individual location. That can take, you know, probably upwards of sometimes, you know, half of a decade or more to be able to do that. So it's one thing to say that we want to do it, but then the actual getting it done, open, operating, fully staffed with the people that know how to do that, because we just haven't done those things in our country in a long time.
What about the prices your customers will pay and ultimately consumers?
They're probably going to go up in the short term. They're going to have to figure out ways to mitigate that through other processes. And sometimes when your input costs go up, your process has to get more efficient and effective. And that's where the automation piece and trying to do more with less comes in.
May I ask, what do you think your business is going to be like over the next year?
I'm cautiously optimistic. You know, I think that there is an opportunity in every situation that you walk into, and we focus on what we can control. The one thing we're going to do is try to figure out every individual customer's needs that they're going to have, you know, with these, because different customers are going to have different needs based on, you know, where they procure things and how they go about building things. We're going to try to be that resource for them to be able to mitigate this as much as possible. I expect to grow this year.
Doug Adams is president of Adams Corp. Thanks so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you.
And now it's time for sports. Oh, wait, it's April. Women's Championship tomorrow, South Carolina and UConn. Men's Final Four tonight, Howard Bryant of Meadowlark Media joins. Howard, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Scott. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, my friend. Let's try April hysteria. women's tournament, final set after South Carolina beat Texas 74-57. UConn throttled UCLA 85-51. Who do you think has the edge in the final tomorrow?
That's a great question. You're talking about one team, UConn, that's won the thing 11 times at Gene Auriemma. Then you're talking about Don Staley in South Carolina. They're the defending champions. So tough to say who's got the edge. I think that Scott, we've been doing this for a long time. You're the champion until somebody beats you. So even though UConn looked phenomenal, even though I think they've got the best player in the country in Paige Beckers, and they look like they are absolutely ready to finally do something that Paige hasn't done, which is to win the championship. She's been in the Final Four almost her entire career, other than the 2023 knee injury, but she's so close. And you want to climb that mountain. Now is the time to do it. But at the same time, you're going up against a championship team that has looked beatable. But here they are again. South Carolina's champion for a reason.
Men's tournament final four tonight. Florida faces Auburn. Houston faces Duke. All the number one seeds in play. First time in the final four since 2008. So I mean, what was March? What was March about?
Yeah, well, it's interesting because the last time it happened, and the only other time it happened was in 2008 in San Antonio, and here we are again in San Antonio. So,
that
you've got great teams. I think that they are the four best teams. They've all been sort of trading being number one or very close to it. I didn't think Auburn was going to get there. Because they can be so erratic, but they've all played close games. They've all won blowouts as well. They all play defense. I think Houston's the one whose offense isn't as good as the other ones. I mean, Duke has got Cooper Flagg, who you're probably going to see him in the NBA in about 6 months. And so every team here has a reason why they can win. You look at even a, you know, a team like Florida that nobody thought was as good as they are, a good team. They haven't, you know, they lost one game since February 1st. So everybody's great. They all play similar styles. Then you've got the superstar with Cooper Flagg and Duke, but they're the youngest team. So here we go.
And of course, last night in the NHL, Alexander Ovechkin of the Washington Capitals tied the NHL's all-time scoring record held by Wayne Gretzky. He scored two goals last night, 39 years old, still playing at such a high level.
Just... And broke his leg this year, by the way.
Right, I'd forgotten that.
And broke his leg in November. Incredible. And I think this is, I mean, this is one of those records, Scott. You're not supposed to break Wayne Gretzky's record, and to have done it in one, and to tie it in one fewer game is sort of also amazing. And I think that when you look at Ovi, the scoring, the goals, the ferocity, the way he plays the game, there's so much to love about what he's done. I think the amazing thing is obviously this is one of those records that you're just never, you never expected anyone, when Gretzky broke Gordie Howe's record at 801 back, you know, 30 years ago, you didn't think anybody was going to get to 894, and here we are. And if he wants to, because he's still playing so well, he could score 950, he could score 1,000 goals if he wants to, if he wants to keep going. But it's fascinating to see it happen, to witness one of the all-time great records go. And I think the thing that I really sort of enjoy about it as well is that this is also what it takes. Because let's not forget, before they won the Cup, you know, 7 years ago, people were thinking that he was finished, that
That's
he was
right.
done.
That's right.
And here he is at the top of the mountain, a Mount Rushmore moment for the unbreakable record about to be broken.
Okay, Howard Bryant of Meadowlark Media, thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure, Scott.
Last year, the video gaming industry brought in around $187 billion. And yes, giants like Nintendo and Electronic Arts generate hit games, but there's a new force at play.
Some of the biggest hits in the industry are coming from developers that are, you know, a team of one person. It kind of goes to show the power dynamics right now in the industry, where small independent developers do have the power and potential to make big video games without the risk that comes with making a giant multi-million dollar project as a big studio.
Later today on All Things Considered, NPR producer and gaming aficionado Vincent Accavino on big changes in gaming. Listen in. Tell your smart speaker to play your member station by name. You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Largely along party lines, the Republican-controlled Senate passed a budget blueprint early this morning that will allow President Trump to advance his agenda. It includes tax cuts while reducing spending on federal programs. The National Weather Service is forecasting more rain today in parts of the South and Midwest, already soaked by days of severe storms. Several communities are still recovering from tornadoes this week that destroyed entire neighborhoods. And in hockey, Alex Ovechkin of the Washington Capitals scored the 894th goal of his career last night, matching the record of hockey great Wayne Gretzky when he retired 26 years ago. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. From Progressive Insurance, working to help protect small businesses and the owners that run them, offering customizable coverages to salons, accounting firms, tradespeople, and more. Learn more at ProgressiveCommercial.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Shortly before 3 a.m. today, the Republican-led U.S. Senate approved a blueprint for trillions in spending for tax, defense, and immigration policy. It's all part of a race for Republican lawmakers to enact key elements of President Trump's domestic policy, but they face some major hurdles to get there. NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales joins us. Claudia, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott.
And Senate Republicans unveiled this plan earlier in the week. What can you tell us about it?
Right. This is a blueprint for a multi-trillion dollar measure that could become a hallmark of Trump's second term. It reimagines defense, energy, immigration, and tax policy spending. So lots of major elements here. That includes an extension of tax cuts passed during Trump's first term that are set to expire by year end. Republicans argue Americans would see their tax bills rise without it, but critics say it will come with a huge price tag that would raise the federal deficit. It would also lift the U.S. debt limit by $5 trillion to avoid a breach this summer. And without that, we could be looking at a default. So a big concern there they're hoping to address. But we should also note this is just the beginning of a very long, complicated process known as budget reconciliation. And that includes a series of legislative hurdles designed to overcome a Senate filibuster.
Because Republicans control the Senate, but only 53 seats, could they ultimately pass this plan with a simple majority? I mean, can they get there?
Maybe, but it's clearly looking to shape up to be an uphill battle. The House has their own blueprint, and there's big differences between the two chambers they're going to need to sort through. And by big, they're more than $1 trillion apart in their blueprints. Now, if both sides can sort those differences, they'll move to pass one final blueprint, start crafting actual text for this massive plan, then try to pass that plan in both chambers on very tight margins. So while there's this lower vote threshold in the Senate, congressional Republicans need to stay virtually united with little room for error.
What are some of the divides between Senate and House Republicans?
Well, Senate Republicans say they want to make those Trump tax cuts permanent, and they claim it will not increase federal debt through an accounting tactic. But even Republican fiscal hawks in the House are not buying it. Then the Senate blueprint aims to reduce the deficit by around $4 billion. That's a small fraction of what House Republicans want to do. They want to cut at least $1.5 trillion. Also in the House, Republicans have directed the Energy and Commerce Committee to cut $880 billion in spending. That's raised the specter that those cuts cannot happen without a significant hit to Medicaid benefits. And some Republican members say that's something they cannot stomach.
How do Republicans overcome the divide? Is that where President Trump steps in?
We expect he will. He's virtually become a congressional closer in terms of getting key legislation past the finish line, whether it's involved direct meetings at the White House with Republican leaders or holdouts, including those fiscal hawks in some cases, and last-minute phone calls to flip Republican no's to yeses. So expect that to ramp up as this process heats up, and he'll likely have to weigh in on that huge divide between the chambers, that at one end we see fiscal hawks who have proven in past congressional sessions they're willing to rebuke leadership, but they have yet to do that this year. And they're going to be facing off against Republicans firmly opposed to Medicaid cuts. So it's shaping up to be one of the biggest obstacles to final passage that will test Republicans' appetite to touch a political third rail in a pivotal moment for the party.
NPR's Claudia Grisales, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
It's been a wild ride for TikTok creators in the U.S. the past few months. A law passed last year that bans the platform unless it is sold by its Chinese owner. Now, President Trump is extending TikTok's sell-by date for another 75 days. With its future still so uncertain, NPR's Chloe Veltman reports creators' fatigue is taking over.
The initial prospect of a TikTok ban brought on strong emotions back in January for creators like Emily Sen.
It feels like I'm losing, like, a really good friend, and that sucks.
Then, after the platform went dark for a few hours on January 18th when the ban took effect and then flickered back to life again, there was widespread confusion and anger. Suddenly, the algorithms seemed different, complained creator Lil Kombucha.
This is not the same TikTok that we used to have.
Now the prevailing emotion among creators seems to be whatever.
I literally have a career on this app and I don't care.
How many times are we gonna do this? I'm done. Like, I'm tired.
The fatigue expressed by TikTok creators P.S. Sirina, Princess Milky, and Connor Babcock relates to what's going on in the broader political landscape. So says Joel Penny. He's an associate professor of communications and media at Montclair State University. Penny points to Trump's suggestion on Thursday that he would consider providing some relief over tariffs to China if a deal could be struck with ByteDance, TikTok's Chinese parent company.
These folks do feel like they're kind of being played with in these bigger political negotiations, feeling uncertain about what's going on.
Wayne State University psychiatrist Arash Chavanbacht says uncertainty is a major cause of stress, of which fatigue is a symptom.
We want to know the outcomes, and when we don't know, we are more prone to the impact of stress.
Another factor is a lack of control.
When we have a lack of control on the fate of what is important and matters to us, and it becomes chronic, we get to a state of learned helplessness. I know I can't do anything about it, and I start to give up.
But it doesn't have to be that way. University of Michigan psychiatrist Michelle Reber says people experiencing emotional fatigue like those TikTokers shouldn't isolate themselves.
Find a group of people who they can talk to, bounce ideas back and forth from, learn from each other.
She says remembering that you've probably experienced uncertainty and a lack of control in the past and proved resilient can also be helpful.
Have you been through this before? May not be exactly the same problem with TikTok, but what has helped you in the past?
Reba adds there's nothing like stepping away from TikTok to help ease the exhaustion. That goes for creators on the platform and the rest of us. Chloe Veltman, NPR News.
You may never quite know what the strategic objective is supposed to be. When a platoon of U.S. Navy SEALs bursts into split-level house in the middle of the night in a town in Iraq where insurgents might be on the roof and roofs next door, and that might be the point. They herd the Iraqi family into a bedroom. They try to scope out a potential insurgent, but then militants attack. The Navy SEALs are surrounded and need support fast.
Jake, this is one. Collapse to us now.
Tracking, but where are you guys?
We're Bilhelm. Look for the blood and the smoke.
It's the film Warfare, based on the experiences of Ray Mendoza, who served in Iraq. He wrote and directed the film alongside Alex Garland, whose movies include Civil War and Ex Machina. Ray Mendoza joins us now. Mr. Mendoza, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So this is based on an actual mission you were on in Ramadi. What happened?
Counterinsurgency was the focus at the time. Ramadi was considered kind of the hotbed of the insurgency. And the goal was to go in and to take back Ramadi sector by sector. And we were to provide overwatch for those missions.
Can I ask about the very beginning of the film? I was surprised by it.
Yeah, which part? With the music video?
Exactly. The 2004 dance hit, Call on Me, Eric Prydz.
Yeah, there's a few purposes that serve. One of them being that the film is based off of memories, and if it didn't happen on that day, it wasn't going to be in the film. And so in 2006, you know, there wasn't a lot of, you know, you can't stream movies or content like you can now. And in a place like Iraq, where a lot of times you have to entertain yourself, you know, videos will get passed around via USB drives, and this was one of many videos. But this one just caused us to be, it was just fun. Obviously, there's some beautiful women in it. There's a guy in there. It's, you know, it's a bit comedic. And so, yeah, it was just something that stuck with us. And then we started watching it more and more until it became a kind of a ritual to watch before we went out. And then it also, just to show how young we were and how silly we were, just kind of these young men doing what young men do when left to their own devices.
That's what kind of got to me about it, because we meet the platoon in their combat gear. You can't tell how young they are, but you sure can tell how young they are when they're dancing along to this video.
Correct. They're all having fun, and it's just a way, you know, when you watch the movie, there's not a lot of a narrative. You don't get the traditional dialogue you see in other movies to help you understand who the character is and their relationships amongst each other. So I think this is a cool snapshot of just kind of who they were.
You had to watch all this in the actual mission. Was it hard to relive it, making a film?
Yeah, I mean, it's been hard just living with it rather than reliving it. This was just one day of many days, but obviously one of the more tragic days for me in my personal life, being that one of them was Elliot Miller, played by Cosmo Jarvis, was a friend of mine, one of my best friends. Reliving it, I don't think it was as hard as coming out of the military, understanding it, just transitioning into civilian world, figuring out what I wanted to do. Some of those mechanisms we create to function every day, when you see tragedy on that scale, the most common mechanism amongst people who serve in Iraq or Afghanistan is just to kind of push it down. And then it's something you think you're going to be able to talk about it with your friends later on. But you never do, because when we come back, we go back to our hometowns, or we go to different commands, or we get out of the military. And so you never get to talk about the emotional components. Doing this together, I think it was very therapeutic for a lot of us. It mended a lot of relationships. And then ultimately, the reason why we did it was for Elliot. He lacks that core memory. He doesn't recall what happened. And so I think coming together to recreate this for him was a great gift for all of us.
I have to ask, you feel for the losses of the Navy SEALs, but I certainly found myself also thinking of the Iraqi family.
Sure.
Innocents shoved into the back bedroom in the middle of the night. Their walls are shot out and people die. You think of them?
Yeah, of course, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, they're I guess, the neutral party. We recognize who they are. But, you know, war is not so black and white sometimes. You know, when you're dealing with an insurgency, which is an enemy that is not uniformed, and there's decisions we have to make, which I think maybe get glossed over or maybe not reported on as much, which is, you know, we're put in these positions to make decisions, sometimes in microseconds. And there's a lot of information you need to process. But I wanted to show that there is that component, which does make it confusing for the soldier as well, not just the family.
The film is so realistic, the combat, the camaraderie. What do you want people who haven't been through it to understand about the people you know?
My focus wasn't on, like, this is what I want civilians to know. I made it for veterans to show that, you're not forgotten, and I want to convey accurately what we all went through. This is just one event of thousands. What I would want civilians to take away from this is to understand when people say thank you for your service, like, do they really know what they're thanking us for? The sacrifice and what that means. What are you sacrificing? And for me, it's, you know, sacrificing your youth. You're forced to grow up really fast.
Can I ask, how are you and your friends doing now?
Yeah, I mean, most of them are great. You know, there's I think there's some that have fallen through the cracks, unfortunately. But yeah, most of them are well. The ones that he's involved in this are doing great. Elliot has two beautiful children, beautiful wife, and yeah, so a lot of guys have gone out. They're doing great things. They're productive members of society.
Writer and director Ray Mendoza, his new film, Warfare, in theaters next week. Thanks so much for being with us, sir.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for having me.
And you're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. When Hurricane Ian ripped through Florida in 2022, thousands of homes and businesses were devastated, including the Lighthouse Cafe in Sanibel Island on Florida's west coast. The cafe was destroyed and forced to shut down. It reopened a couple of years later in a new location, but without one of its signature features, a wooden sign that welcomed customers. Went missing after the hurricane until it found its way back this year. Dan Bilheimer is the owner of the Lighthouse Cafe and joins us now. Thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Scott. Thank you for having me.
Tell us about that sign.
Well, the sign was a fixture for many decades. My uncle, Mike, owned the cafe for 33 years. And during that period of time, the welcome to the Lighthouse Cafe, where good food and times are served daily, was given to him by his son. It was placed in front on our front desk. It was one of the first things customers saw that welcomed them in.
And what happened to your restaurant during the hurricane?
Well, Hurricane Ian hit Sanibel just right and essentially covered the entire island with water. We received about 6 feet inside the cafe, and our ceilings are pretty low, Scott. So, I mean, we're talking 8-foot ceilings with 6 feet of water. It pretty much destroyed everything. When you recover from something like that, it's really hard to know where to start. But you pick up the first lighthouse picture and walk it out to the side of the road and throw it down. And then you pick up the second one and then a chair and, you know, on and on until you empty your restaurant. And the sign was a part of that. Everything that went underwater went into the rubbish pile outside.
But I gather somebody saw it eventually, right?
Well, we are blessed with many great customers. And on this particular occasion, Kevin and Lily were walking by and saw that the sign sticking out of the top of this massive rubbish pile. And they grabbed it. They said, you know, Dan might want that back someday. Took it up to their home in Boston and kept it for 3 years, almost 3 years, until they came back, until the island recovered enough and opened up enough to where they felt comfortable to come back. And that's when they brought it in to me.
Wow. What did that feel like?
Well, I got to be honest with you. When they took it out of the bag and it was that particular sign, I thought these things only happen in movies. But, Scott, I got to tell you, I went right back there. The shock and the dismay and the what just happened to my life. I mean, we lost our house. We lost 2 cars. We lost the business. We lost 2 stores. Like, essentially everything. And to go back to that place, it was wild. And to receive it in this new context, this new spot, and it's bigger, and it's better, and everything is coming back, and it's been nothing but light and love. From the customer standpoint and, you know, this rebirth, if you will, to see this old sign in this new context, I mean, I had to go back in the office and kind of compose myself. It just way out of left field.
Yeah. Dan Bilheimer owns the Lighthouse Cafe back again in Sanibel Island, Florida. Thanks so much for being with us.
It has been my pleasure, Scott. Thank you so much for having me.
This is NPR News.
This is Tracy Chapman's goal when she writes a song.
Every song is like a snapshot, 3 to 5 minutes. You have to tell a story or express something completely.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds just
Tracy Chapman on her music and Standing the Test of Time. Sunday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. The United Nations is calling on nations around the world to help Myanmar recover from the March 28th earthquake. UNA Chief Tom Fletcher is visiting the city of Mandalay near the epicenter of the 7.7 quake. More than 3,300 people died. Ukrainian officials say the death toll from a Russian missile attack yesterday has risen to 18. The strike took place in President Volodymyr Zelensky's hometown. And in men's college basketball, Florida plays Auburn and Houston plays Duke tonight in the final four games in the NCAA championship. The winners face each other Monday night. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. A head-spinning week for the economy. President Trump's tariffs hitting just about every nation and every industry. Here's something that got less attention. The president also moved to close a popular loophole known as the de minimis rule. It allows millions of U.S. shoppers to buy products, everything from shoes and underwear to lamps and tools, directly from retailers in China and Hong Kong. Till now, you could make those purchases without paying import taxes. That's about to change. NPR's Brian Mann has been following this. Brian, thanks for being with us.
Hi there, Scott.
How big is closing this loophole?
Well, Scott, it's huge, really, in two ways. First, it's going to affect a lot of American consumers who have come to rely on big Chinese e-commerce firms like Shein and Temu for a lot of low-cost products, as you mentioned. This is everything from fast fashion to toys and tools. These companies have built global brands marketing on social media platforms like Instagram and TikTok, where influencers celebrate when their packages arrive.
Check out my latest Shein haul. Ballet flats are trending, and this quilted pair has a great cushion sole.
With marketing like that, Scott, over the last decade, U.S. shoppers fell in love with these companies. Direct-to-consumer international shipments exploded to around $54 billion in sales last year, roughly 4 million packages coming every day.
What's going to change with Trump's new executive order?
So under this de minimis rule, shoppers who place orders worth under $800, and you can get a lot of low-cost dresses or office supplies for that amount, they haven't until now been hit with duties or taxes. And they also get their packages really fast because they haven't had to wait for the usual customs and inspection process. But under the president's executive order, that's going to come to a screeching halt May 2nd. Every package will now face a tariff of 30%. Eventually, anything consumers order in this way is going to face a minimum fee of $50. And remember, if you're buying a $2 t-shirt or a $10 skirt, that amount of tax is a huge markup. And Scott, one thing that's interesting here, a study published last year predicts this change is going to cost Americans more than $10 billion a year in higher prices, with much of that burden hitting lower income shoppers.
Buying directly from Chinese and Hong Kong retailers is so popular in America. Why change the rule?
Yeah, that's a great question. And a lot of President Trump's tariffs have obviously been controversial, but this move actually has broad bipartisan support, backing from a bunch of different public safety and industry groups. And they have really two arguments. First, they say this has been unfair competition, all these cheap, untaxed goods flooding American markets, pricing out U.S. manufacturers. Second, government officials believe a lot of illegal stuff, including street fentanyl, the drug, is coming across the border hidden in these packages. I spoke about this with Kimberly Glass. She heads the National Council of Textile Organization. That's a trade group that supports U.S. clothes makers.
And it's regrettably facilitated fentanyl and other illicit products like forced labor products to our front doors, on our steps, babies products that are failing to meet FDA standards.
Now, I should say these big e-commerce companies like Shein and Temu say they do have ethical supply chains and quality control. But what we know is that this change, it's going to be a huge blow to their business model.
Brian, this executive order only affects shipments from China and Hong Kong. What about products that are sold directly from other countries?
Yeah, so for now, shoppers can still buy directly from retailers shipping from other countries like Bangladesh, India, and Vietnam. But the Trump administration has signaled that it plans to close these de minimis loopholes in the months ahead for the entire globe. They're phasing this in slowly because it turns out it's a big challenge for U.S. Customs and Border Protection to process and tax all these millions of packages. Scott, Trump actually tried to close this loophole back in February, and at that time, his team said they just weren't ready. Now, White House officials say they have systems in place to manage this change, but some of the experts I've been speaking to think we could see big bottlenecks as retailers and shoppers adapt to these new rules.
NPR correspondent Brian Mann, thanks so much.
All right, Scott, thank you.
Social movements have long used music to try to spread messages and rally support. Musicians from across Taiwan gathered in the southern port city of Kaohsiung recently to remind people of the precarious geopolitical situation in which they find their island. Ashish Valentine reports.
Last weekend, tens of thousands of fans gathered to see some of the best Taiwan's music scene has to offer. The festival, which receives some local government funding, took over the largest harbor in Taiwan, hence its name, Megaport. Although they came here to blow off steam, escalating tensions between Taiwan and China won many fans and artists' minds. Last month, Taiwan's president Lai Ching-te labeled Beijing as a, quote, hostile foreign force. Many bands urged fans to stay united, saying this isn't the first time Taiwan's people have risked their lives for a better future. Taking the stage on the festival's second day, rock band Sorry Youth surprised everyone halfway through their set by debuting a cartoon based on a story even a kid could recognize. Three little pigs, Taiwanese pigs that is, talk about the news, while a certain big bad wolf lurks in the background.
You guys really think there will be a war?
They talk about sending their kids abroad before the third little pig interrupts, saying they should stay and defend their home.
But what do we do? We're just normal people. What power do we have?
Just one ordinary person has no power. But what about 10,000 ordinary people? 100,000? A million? So many people sacrifice themselves so we can live the way we do now. The rest is up to us.
The band launched into a song called Justice in Time. It pays tribute to generations of activists who resisted four decades of dictatorship, which only ended in 1987, and promises them future generations will keep their hard-won democracy safe. They weren't the only artists who worried about a potential Chinese invasion. Hip-hop artist Yang Shuya's single, 2045, wonders what struggling for democracy would mean in Taiwan if everything burns to ashes. She imagines Taiwan as a war zone under Chinese occupation, basic freedoms gone. Not everyone playing at Megaport was so forward, though. Yang says it's a result of larger tensions in the music scene.
So many artists from Taiwan decide they need to go to China to develop their careers.
The result, she says, is only a handful dare to speak up openly. But Yang says she has no interest in going to China or playing by their rules.
There's never been a separation between music and politics. Music is political.
For many of the artists and fans at Megaport, they'll use the festival to celebrate and protest for as long as they can. For NPR News, this is Ashish Valentine in Kaohsiung, Taiwan.
Bud Stanley writes obituaries for a living. He knows you are more likely to be killed by a cow than a shark, among many other mordant facts. One night he has a disaster of a blind date, gets bad news from his ex-wife, goes home, has too much to drink, and then writes too much.
Bud Stanley, the first man to perform open-heart surgery on himself, died today in a hot air balloon accident. He was 44. His wife, Miss France, has confirmed the death.
At the wire service where he works the next day, the security guard tells him, "I'm so sorry, Mr. Bud, but it appears you are maybe expired." Bud Stanley had written and posted his own obituary. "I see you've called in dead" is the new novel from John Kenney, the longtime New Yorker contributor. He joins us now from our studios in New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Scott.
Quite an inventive obit he writes for himself, isn't it?
It is. It's more wishful thinking than actual fact. It's one of those late night things that he shouldn't have done.
Is it, in addition to being maybe a product of too much to drink, a kind of electronic Freudian slip? Is that what he's really feeling about himself?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Bud is a guy who is lost but doesn't quite know it. As you said, he's 2 years into a divorce. His wife has left him. He's lost the spirit of his job, and he's not quite sure what to do. So he's sitting there making up these absolutely ridiculous things about his own life, kind of wondering what the point of it all is.
Mm. He's fired, but then he can't be fired. What happens?
Well, they desperately want to fire him, but then after a few days, they realize that he is dead to the company's enormous system, and they cannot legally fire a dead person.
Since he can't quite stop living or working, Bud starts going to funerals of people who makes you wonder maybe you should have been going to them all the time before.
Yeah, the catalyst for that first wake he goes to is his ex-wife's mother passes away, and he was kind of close with her, and he goes, and that's a nightmare because he's seeing his ex-wife for the first time in 2 years. She's happily remarried to a far better looking and more interesting man with an English accent. And
as she tells him too, yeah.
Indeed. After the wake, he meets a young woman who is there for no other reason than she wanted to come to the wake and funeral of a stranger. And Bud is stunned by this and says, "Well, why?" And she said, "Well, it's the secret." And he says, "The secret to what?" And she said, "Well, you have to find that out." And she suggests a funeral to him, and he goes, and he keeps going. That's really the essence. It's this journey, physical and emotional journey, that Bud is making with his good friend Tim to these wakes and funerals.
And tell us about Tim. He's an especially vital character, and a lot going on in his life, doesn't he?
Yeah. So after Bud is divorced, he finds a small apartment in Brooklyn, and it's owned by this sort of it's a Gatsby-esque character, except he's a true Renaissance man. He's this remarkable guy. He was in a bad accident and is in a wheelchair. And yet his physical wound doesn't keep him from living and from every few months having a Gertrude Stein-esque salon in Brooklyn for sort of ne'er-do-wells, part-time poets and cellists. And Bud finds a community with Tim and relies on Tim in a way that he desperately needs. You know, in a way, I think the bulk of this story is about male friendship. Mm-hmm. You know, my wife has many close friends, and the intimacy with which they talk, whether it's on the phone or in person, is so radically different than myself with my very small group of guy friends. You know, I'll say, you know, "How you doing?" And they'll say, "Fine." What they really mean is, "I'm doing terrible. I wake up at 3 a.m. crying. I lost my job and I'm worried about money."
What sparked your interest in obituaries?
I was a journalism major in college, and as part of the many different assignments we had, one of them was to write our own obituary. And I did not remotely take it seriously, which I know will come as a surprise to you, Scott. And so it stuck with me, but I grew up in Boston, and my parents always read the Boston Globe obituaries. They called it the Irish sports page. I find them fascinating because there are these whole lives in 200, 300, 400 words, and when they're done well, and they often are, you know, it's a hard thing to do to capture someone's life, the little nuances, not just where they went to school or their children's names. I find them really fascinating.
I came across some words recently. Art Buchwald.
Great man.
Ostensibly a humorist like you.
Absolutely.
Once said, I don't know what happens to us when we die. The question is, why are we here in the first place?
Yeah, and that's an individual question, and I know my answer, which is to try to be a decent friend and a great father and a semi-unannoying husband and to try to enjoy myself. You know, I did want to share, it's an intense subject, death, but the flip side of it is this valve release of humor. And I very much wanted that to be part of the book. The catalyst for the book came in 2019. I'm one of five brothers, Boston Irish family, and one of my brothers passed away in 2019, Tom, and I dedicate the book to him, a really remarkable guy. Like our father and grandfathers, he was a firefighter and just a big, handsome guy who loved life and loved his job. And he was on the Massachusetts FEMA team down at 9/11, and we think he contracted his illness, pancreatic cancer, during his time at 9/11. But during those 5 months, we would visit my brothers and I. I'd come up from the Boston area. And his wife called and said, you know, you really should get up. And I arrived first, and Tom was in a lounge chair with a blanket on him, far thinner than his normal self, but still very much in there in that dark Irish humor. And we chatted, and I heard a car pull into the driveway. And I saw it was my other brothers, and I turned to Tom and I said, the others are here. And with this Buster Keaton-like stone face, but a little grin on his face, he dropped his head to one side and dropped his arm off the chair and, trying to hide a smile, said, tell them they're too late. And I thought,
can I laugh?
Absolutely, because I did too. And I thought, I want that in a book. I want to write a funny-ish book about death, because it gave me chills to, in the face of the great unknown, he knew what was about to happen. He was able to find that dark, wonderful humor that makes life worth living.
John Kenny, his new novel, I See You've Called In Dead. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Scott.
Weekend Edition is a production of NPR News, which is solely responsible for its content. Like a story you heard on this or another NPR program? Share it with a friend at npr.org. While there, you can also hear stories you missed, enjoy expanded content, or connect to your favorite member station.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Proven Winners with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens for gardens and landscapes at garden centers nationwide. ProvenWinnersColorChoice.com/NPR. From the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.